Hey, 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 it's Tom Douglas.
And Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And we are at Large Studios today, in case you're wondering why we don't have a studio audience. Thank you for joining us, as we're here every week, Saturday and Sunday. Except last week we had a little foible. We had a best of show instead. What else? I'm chef owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including Palace Kitchen, which is celebrating its 27th year this come March. And right now we're really all in on the Dahlia 30th anniversary. So I guess Palace must be 26.
You must be getting really old, Tom Douglas, because 27 and 30 for restaurateur is not exactly everybody's fit. I mean, that's... Yeah. Most people are celebrating 3, 5, 10. You're in the 30.
Anyway, and you, chef?
I am the proud owner of Luc in Madison Valley, almost 10 years old, and Lule downtown Seattle at the Sheraton Grand.
All right. So we are here. We're going to do 2 hours today, and we are excited to have you listening in your gardens, in your kitchens, on the road, you name it.
Hopefully you're cooking something while you're listening.
I love kitchen stores, and I happen to be at U Village. I haven't been there in quite a long time, and I walked into the new Williams-Sonoma there, which I think used to be
What do you mean by new?
Yeah, it used to be a Pottery Barn or something in that same space across from the Starbucks and pasta.
Oh, yeah.
It is huge. It felt so much more like the original Sur La Table. You remember the original Shirley Collins Sur La Table place market?
That
was
sure.
Super crowded. You walked in and there was kitchen utensils everywhere. I love the feeling of that store.
Right, right.
And this particular Williams-Sonoma has got everything. And I think of them being a more curated store than Sur La Table. But this one, holy smokes. I was overwhelmed. It was awesome.
You've been overwhelmed. That must be a good store to go to. I'll check it out.
Check it out. We have a big show today. October is National Seafood Month, and to celebrate, we have a captain in the Bristol Bay Salmon Fishing Fleet and a chef from Fisherman's Restaurant that are going to join us to talk about fish prep, Bristol Bay, which had its 8th largest catch ever. Awesome. And the most sustainable way to enjoy seafood. Also, we're going to head over to the Red Mountain AVA. We're just going to leave it at that. And learn about wine from that area, which is about 15 miles east of our farm there in southern west.
Beautiful mountain. If you've never been, you owe it to yourself a little trip there. It's beautiful.
We're going to take some questions from you, our listeners. Came through our Facebook page, and we'll discuss Bon Appetit magazine's Andy Barragani's what he calls essential cooking rules and share some of our own and maybe even agree, disagree a little bit.
That would be good.
I saw a couple in there. It's like, come on, dude. We're going to hit the round table this week for our taste of the week, which I believe Tina is going to join in on. Is that true, Tina?
I'm excited to share with you some little weird treat that I found in Los Angeles, California over the weekend.
Ever since you went plant-based, you've come up with
all
more
kinds of weird stuff.
More weird stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and now I'm finding all these really interesting purveyors of, you know, kind of crafted things like the peanut butter I had. And this is a strange little treat I'm excited to share with you guys. I even brought you some.
Ooh.
To try your very own self.
Okay, we're going to try it.
You're going to try it.
Nice. I like it. What else do I have to say? You know, interesting times out there. Matt Dillon announced the closing of Sitka and Spruce, and says that there's going to be a reckoning here in Seattle. And
I think he's on the money.
I think he's on the money, too. So it's going to be interesting to
see. Oh, we agree on that one.
What do you guys mean when you say a reckoning? About what?
It's tough sledding right now. And I think
in the restaurant industry?
Absolutely. Yeah. Very, very. It's getting harder by the minute.
So it's going to be over the next 6 months to a year to see what the fallout is. Well, there's a lot of things, right? There's an awful lot of dining seats out there. So I think it's overcrowded a bit. And when you split up all the diners that are available into more and more seats, then you've got that issue, supply and demand issue.
Which is to be reminded to most people, then unless you're a corporate chain restaurant, most restaurants make very little profit. So when the increase of volume arise, then you are deprived of your profit. And any business without a profit can only be sustainable for so long.
and that's just one piece.
Yeah, that's right? One piece.
City Council just unanimously passed a new ancillary business rule for businesses that are associated with a hotel, and which is a tremendous new tax. We are estimating to ourselves somewhere around $24,000 a month in tax with this new business tax, because we happen to be in the same building as the Andra Hotel at Lola, right? Those $24,000 a month.
It's
not trivial.
No, that's, you know, it's, I'm just saying.
Several people.
It's on top of many, many things that have happened. And so the good news is our teams are getting better paid. The bad news is there's nothing left to pay them.
Correct.
So that's...
The problem is they're getting better paid, but they might be out of a job.
No. I don't think they'll be out of a job, honestly. I'm not whining in that way. I'm just saying that it's going to change, right? Things are going to flip around a bit. And I do think it's going to be more difficult for non-owner-operated operations, because when you're owner operated, you suck up some of that salary yourself and you don't have to live by those rules as much. Or when you're small, like under 20 employees, things of that world. So it's going to be an interesting time. But I guess I was just pointing out, today I read on the way to work that all the Henry's taverns closed down. Palomino closed down over the weekend. We're just going to see. We're going to see what happens.
And that's also it's a warning for the consumer, because prices are going to keep rising. In order to be sustainable. I mean, there is only so many places you can take money from. And the first one to think about is the price increase in goods. And my purveyors are all rising their prices, and we have to keep following that just to meet those price increases. But then we have to face all the other charges that come around. So there are definitely going to be some adjustment for dining, for sure.
As I hear this, I'm compelled to ask, how do we help? How does a community come together and sort of, you know, there's nothing better than having a great restaurant and have a place to go when you have friends in town, when you have things happening, you enjoy food from the city. Like, is now the time to sort of support your restaurants and eat out? Is now the time to sort of just, like, keep your eye on it? What do we do?
Stay aware of it. You know, the restaurants aren't going to all restaurants aren't going to go out of business. That's not the point. But there is what Matt said in his email post and what
no, absolutely not.
For the Seattle Times was that there's going to be a reckoning, and I think there is definitely going to be a reckoning, and it's just going to be interesting to see where the fallout is. I said over 5 years ago when I decided to go 15 now, it was a couple years before 15 now. I said that if it puts us out of business, it puts us out of business. You know, I believe in it. I believe in fair wages. I believe in health care and things like that. But the customer has to be willing to pay the price. And the number one complaint we get on our web reviews is too expensive. Yeah. So that's just – and we're at no profit at this point in time and have been for 18 months. So I don't know what to do about that. So it'll be interesting. Okay, up next, Michael Jackson is here. He's a fleet of ship, a boat – owner in the fleet up at Bristol Bay. It's part of our October's National Seafood Month celebration, and we're going to talk about what's going on in the world of seafood on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiroder, Chef in the Hat.
And, you know, October is National Seafood Month to celebrate the local fishing organizations. The Port of Seattle and the Seattle Propeller Club have joined together through Seafood 101, a whole campaign around this, Chef Terry. The goals of the campaign are, one, to encourage folks to eat more seafood and discover its nutritional value, and two, to highlight the commitment to sustainability through responsible management. Fisheries can exist long-term without compromising the ecosystem. And three, we're here to celebrate the economic value of the maritime and fishing industries and the diversity of the career opportunities. So have you ever fished on a commercial fishing boat? Have you ever been on one?
Never. I would love to.
Well, our next
but I have never done that.
Our next guest is the guy to talk to.
Yes, I think I can get an invitation.
He might take you out on the lovely Kelly J., which is his fishing boat. Hi, Michael Jackson.
Good morning.
I thought that was his wife.
It is the lovely Kelly J because it's named after my wife, who is the Kelly J. And anytime you name a boat after your wife, you better put lovely in front of it. So, Chef Terry, you are more than welcome to come on my vessel at any time during the season in Bristol Bay. Love to have you.
All right.
So Bristol Bay is a hot topic around here, as you know, Michael. I'm a big Terry and I are both big proponents of stopping the Pebble Mine. That's proposed in the headwaters of Bristol Bay, the last great salmon run left on Earth. You've been in D.C. recently to kind of talk with our senators about that. How did that go?
I have been. And first, I want to thank both of you for having me on board and making this kind of a mouthpiece for our organization, the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. We represent 1,855 drift fleet members, and I went back to speak for our fleet and met with congressional leaders, Senate leaders, and it was a very, very, very fruitful trip. They heard the passion in our voice. They heard our message, and they are fighting for getting science back into this draft evaluation. So it was very, very fruitful. Thanks for asking.
To summarize for listener, the fight was for?
We're fighting against the pebble mine, and how we're doing it is the draft environmental impact statement was rushed through without any science. And Senator Murkowski is head of the appropriation. She came out and said, hey, and we're not going to give you any more money until you guys put science back into the equation. And that's all we're asking is science. Make it a science-based, not a politics-based decision. So thanks again for having me here.
And Maria Cantwell's heavy in on this, too. I know I'm doing an event with her next week or in two. But, so let's talk about Bristol Bay salmon and Bristol Bay seafood and you're catching, along with 1,800 other fishermen, this wonderful product. We had the biggest run in a long time. Well, not the biggest in a long time, but a very large run again this year. I heard the eighth largest run ever.
Well, let's put it this way. It's the largest run in the history of Bristol Bay economically, the highest value run. So we're setting records economically. We're setting records as far as sustainability, run returns. Our runs in the past 3 years have set historical records, the biggest runs ever. And why is that? Because our habitat. And I know, Chef Tom, you've been a huge proponent of keeping that habitat safe. You've been up to Bristol Bay. You've been in a good friend of mine, Mark Titus's film, The Wild. And so the reason we're having these successes is because we've got pristine habitat. We need to keep it that way.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing down here. We're trying to restore all that habitat that we got rid of down here. And why do it again up in the North End?
It's very hard to restore. It's much easier to keep it as is.
You've brought along your friend, Chef Nick Novello. He's the culinary director at Pier 57 downtown Seattle here, Miner's Landing. Welcome, Nick. How are you?
Hey, how's it going today, Tom and Terry? Thank you very much for having me on. Really appreciate it. Michael, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You've been busy this morning. You brought us a nice plate of warm salmon. What do we have
here? Yes, sir. So we wanted to do it up in good old Pacific Northwest style fashion. We did some Alderwood smoked salmon right there on Pier 57 out of the salmon cooker, courtesy of one of the, you know, there's a couple of major producers up there in Bristol Bay, and one of them is Trident Seafoods that we work really closely with, and they heard we were going to be a part of this, so they came by and hooked us up with a nice case of some Bristol Bay sockeye, so we can have this morning, and I smoked it for a couple hours, 5 a.m. this morning on some alderwood, some butter, a little bit of seasoned salt, a little bit of parsley and some lemon, called it a day, you know, so this is a kind of a showcase for what's to come on our Bristol Bay salmon menus.
You talk about the way that salmon came, and, you know, I buy a lot of Bristol Bay sockeye. It's all frozen, the stuff that I buy. If it's slacked out properly, which I mean is you don't take it out of the cryovac, put it underwater and try to thaw it quickly. You know, it's only an inch and a half thick at the most, right? So it takes a couple hours to slack from frozen. It is a pristine product. Frozen, fresh, you name it, right, huh, Chef?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the old idea, I mean, there was a time in my life where I was like, I can't do frozen fish. And there was a reason for that. The fish was never frozen correctly. But the way that you guys do the freezing on the boats nowadays, you know, it's so instant and frozen instantly, basically. Then the product does not get hurt. It actually benefits from it.
I like to say it's better than fresh if it's done properly because you know that it's been taken care of. When we catch our fish, the minute they come out of the net, we bleed them by ripping the gills. They land on a mat or a trampoline, and they're immediately slid into refrigerated seawater at about 33 to 35 degrees. So they're very well taken care of. They're no longer bruising because we're welcoming
them
aboard.
Yeah.
We've bled them. And if you remember, not too long ago, most of our product went into the can. Because we've had to shift to meet market demands, it's more filet or H&G, and that's why we've improved the quality.
That's also why you've increased the value.
Absolutely.
Let's be realistic. You're going to pay more for a beautiful side of fish than you are for a can of fish.
Yeah.
So they did a lot of investment in their fleets, as in because they were, you know, mainly a canning run before operation. Before, they had to invest in the refrigeration to really make them what they are today. And, you know, well over 75% of that fleet is refrigerated and it's hitting that cold water. And, you know, that is what that quality means. And that's what Bristol Bay is bringing to the table. So it's awesome.
Here's the other thing I'll say about that is I'm not maligning canned salmon even at all. It's just a different product, right? But if you've never tried canned salmon, but you're a big tuna person, I would try the switch. I mean,
oh,
my goodness.
Absolutely.
When you get canned sockeye salmon bellies, or you're talking about some beautiful absolutely. Fish right out of a can.
And it makes a great spread. I mean,
salmon
melts.
Salmon niçoise out of a tuna niçoise. So, yeah, it's yeah. really a great combination.
Yeah, I mean,
my
it's
heart is smiling
beautiful
hearing
thing.
You guys talk. I'm not even paying you guys to say this. So thank you. I eat it. I eat it all the
oh,
time.
Oh, wait, wait, wait.
Well, maybe I
you don't know. You don't know.
Yeah, you don't have to. So, Nick, you have, you're the chef for the Crab Pod, the Fisherman's Restaurant and Bar, Salmon Cooker, Alaska Sourdough Bakery. Pier 57 is right in the forefront of our waterfront now, especially with the viaduct coming down. Must be an exciting time down there.
Yeah, it's so exciting. You know, I've been, you know, spent some time at some great Seattle institutions and just kind of getting them up to snuff into where, you know, we can enjoy them with our families and have the great, great time. And really doing that with the waterfront now and super excited to be a part of it.
Are you nervous about our changing environment? Are you nervous about the weather? And the warming of the Arctic? I mean, there's some pretty shocking numbers coming out this
time. I have concerns. Yeah, I'm keeping my eye on it, trying to read as much as I can. But at this stage, it's more learning than being able to talk with any authority. So, yeah, I'm nervous. I'm not going to lie.
It's going to be an interesting time over the next 25 years to see what we've done to the Earth and how we can manage to either live with it or try and fix it or whatever the opportunity is.
We're living with global warming, which is turning it into global weirding for all of us. Yeah.
And we know salmon are very sensitive to temperature.
Yes.
That was one of my concerns about why Bristol Bay is getting such an incredible run, is that it's coming up from the south and then not being in the south as much as it used to be. So we will find out that all coming up. Up next, thank you both, Nick and Michael. Up next, it's your pro tips. And maybe, Nick, you want to stay for an extra segment with us and give us some of your pro tips on for our listeners to chew on. So, on Cairo Radio, up 97.3. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's Tom Douglas.
And Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
We are invited Mr. Nick Novello to stay with us for this next segment. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it, y'all.
Chef of the Pier 57 restaurants, the Crab Pot, the Fisherman's Restaurant and Bar, the Salmon Cooker, and the Alaska Sourdough Bakery, all down there on Pier 57. And that's the same pier, I think, that has the Ferris wheel. Is that true?
Yes, sir, it is. And Wings Over Washington.
And Wings Over Washington.
Wow, it's a busy pier.
Yeah, you know, it is. It is. It's, you know, it's kind of the thing where you come down and do a day. You know, it's so great.
Yeah.
And with the viaduct coming down, it looks like a whole new country down there.
Yeah,
it's
a
like,
new park.
You don't even recognize it.
It's a new city down there. It's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so our segment that we're going to jump in here to here, Chef, in the chapeau, Chef Thierry, are pro tips. And Tina, our producer, got this from the Bon Appetit senior editor, Andy Baragani. He published a list of these rules. And I think I'm just going to go through top to bottom, and we're going to kind of go quick. And I've asked Nick to stay and maybe jump in where you feel like you have a strong opinion on something there, Nick. So a group-like task. And so that doesn't make a lot of sense what he's trying to say there in that title. But to me, what he's saying is group your tasks so that you're more efficient. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Like, so if you're making apple pie, just peel all your apples, get it done. Even if they brown a little bit, it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's an advantage time-wise. It's also a chef thing, kind of prep to do.
It's organization, right?
Exactly. Just be organized and, you know, get all your stuff ready, peel all your vegetable, cut all your vegetable, and then start cooking.
And the thing I would preface that with is clean your kitchen first. Don't try to start a new project in a messy kitchen. I hate that. Nick, he also says, when it comes to dairy, go full fat, no questions.
That's definitely it right there. I'm a definite big opponent of having that, you know, full fat in there. I wouldn't know a reason not to.
Yeah, if you're making polenta, you know, like a creamy, cheesy polenta, use whole milk or use half and half. Or
I also like, well, I love half and half because it is half and half. It's, you know, it's half and half. So my thing is I utilize that heavy cream in my, you know, my mac and cheeses and things like that and all that jazz. So it's awesome.
Yeah, I think if you're going to use dairy, go that way. If you can't have heavy dairy, then choose something else.
Chef, he says, skip boxed or canned stock when making soups, braises, or stews. Now, I know what you're going to say, absolutely, but I'm also going to say, are you comfortable in any area using a pre-made canned or boxed stock?
Yes.
Where?
In soups.
In soups, really.
In soups, if you use, well, I'm also, by the way, you have to be extremely picky and, you know, looking into your stock box. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to buy a box of stock, you just make sure you buy one that's not salted and all that stuff, because otherwise...
So you go low salt.
Yeah, no salt. Yeah, because I don't believe in making salt stock, because you're going to reduce that down and cook it down. It's going to increase the salt and you're going to have damaged goods. So, but if you find a good stock, there's no reason why not. But my first inclination would be in soup, because in soup, when you start, you sweat all your vegetables, you add all your... You can add some wine, and then you add that stock. So now you have a profile that is a little bit more sustainable. And then, you know, you cook it down a little bit, add some fresh herbs. So you have definitely helped rising the taste. So
I would have guessed just the opposite. I would have said not in soup, but in a braise or a stew, because you're really kind of cooking it down with the meat and
right.
everything.
Well, it's same concept.
It's okay, yeah. Okay, Nick, know your oils. So extra virgin oil can be robust and peppery, at other times fruity and smooth. Nuts and seed oils are generally quite forward, but they can also go rancid really fast.
Mm-hmm.
So know your oils. Understand what a fresh oil is and a old.
Yeah, and what to cook with and what not to cook with. You know what I mean? There's people that just, like, you know, use the EVO for everything, and they're sitting there trying to, you know, have their pan at smoking point and their whole kitchen's filled with smoke, and they hate cooking because it splashes everywhere, you know. So, you know, you want to go with kind of a canola high heat oil that'll be able to, you know, conduct that well and not splash everywhere. So.
And then use the nice oil for a finishing.
Yeah, use a nice oil. I am a big fan of nut oils on my salads, especially during this fall time right now. You know, a little bit of walnut oil on top of some, you know, butternut squash with a little bit of cinnamon. I mean, you got it right.
And I think one of the big safeties, if you buy a can of walnut oil and it's too much for one seasoning or one meal, put it in the fridge. You'll be much better off having it seasoned in the fridge than having it rancid in your
right,
cupboard.
It'll last months longer in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Chef Thierry, blanch or boil vegetables in heavily salted water. Now, we had this conversation about cooking pasta in salted water. To me, it's not intuitive to do this, because here we are. We always say use unsalted butter so you can control the salt. You just said use unsalted stock so you can control the stock, the salt in the stock. And I just think this is I don't agree. Like, just,
I don't
just
agree either.
In water.
I agree with you for
yeah.
once.
Whoa!
I agree with you in terms of, I'd rather, you know, in the world we live in today, we have beautiful salt, finishing salt and everything. Just put the salt at the end. Yeah. Plus, when I was raised as a kid, my green beans were always salted. The water was always salted. The green beans were always salted. Mm-hmm. You know, I have not salted a green bean in years, or the water of the green beans in years. I like it better. I like the taste of the green beans. First of all, it comes through much better. And I can put a little finishing salt on top and be much
and
better.
Yeah, and you get the little crunch from the salt. Okay, Nick, this one says, please grate all your cheese yourself. And I think the intent here is that you don't pre-grate or you don't buy pre-grated cheese. And that for me, my intent would be, like, if I'm making a pizza or something like that, instead of pre-grating all the Parmesan at the end, I like to grate right over the pizza. To me, it's a fresher product.
Oh, yeah.
You have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'll definitely tell you that, you know, your shredded cheese that you're buying is going to be, there's going to be an extra layer of sealer that's going to be on there to allow it to be open to the air and things of that to stand up to oxidization. So if you can skip that, you want to, because that's not going to melt as well, and it's definitely not cheese. So you want to go with your block of cheese, you know, right off there. If you have a cool cheese monger you like to use, go ahead and pick up something from a bigger block and just grate it right over the top of there, like Tom says, and let the heat from the actual dish, you know, kind of just melt that. It's really great on pasta. I mean, right now I'm picturing three meatballs stacked high and just grating Reggiano right on top.
And, you know, the reality is it doesn't break down then, too. If you're just lightly melting it, the cheese doesn't separate from whey and fat, right? Exactly.
Once again, you can taste the product. You can taste the cheese.
Okay, Terry, he says two acids are better than one. And I think his point is vinegar on its own can be abrasive, but combine it with some citrus juice or zest and they balance each other out. So, I mean, there's no difference than adding citrus juice is 50% sugar. So there's no sense, you know, no difference. So I don't agree with him.
I don't necessarily agree with two are better than one. I think what you have the one is make something out of that. So if your vinegar is a little bit too abrupt, just take it, put a little dash of sugar or honey, bring it to a boil, reduce it down a little bit. You'll have a concentration of sugar that will increase, and then you'll have a better product on your hand, and it won't be as abrasive.
It doesn't hurt to add the citrus, but all he's really doing is adding sugar. to the vinegar. And okay, Nick, boy, we're doing this like hardball style.
Blowing right through it.
Add hard herbs early. Save tender herbs for the end. So hard herbs being bay leaves, thyme, rosemary, sage, and the tender herbs being things like parsley, mint, cilantro, basil. You agree with that?
Yeah, you want to allow those hard herbs time for the natural oils and essential essence of them to come out of in the dish. You know, you think about using, when you drop your herbs, I like to start a pan sometimes where you're starting with garlic, maybe drop some sage in there where it kind of starts and you release that aromatics and that savoriness and flavor profile of that sage, and then start your dish the rest of the way, you know, and then you can go ahead and finish with some nice finer herbs, your fresher herbs, like your nice parsley or your maybe even some microgreens or something like that.
Microgreens are so popular right now as finishing. They're not really herbs, but they are just little versions of radishes or beets.
Well, they're intense flavor, so in some cases you can use them as herb, like microbasil and all that stuff. It's pretty potent.
So his next one is have a secret weapon. I'll tell you what my secret weapon is in the kitchen. I think I've said this before in the show. Chipotle Tabasco. I love it because it adds a little bit of smokiness. It adds a little bit of heat. That's my thing. That and anchovy paste are my things to kind of build on.
My new weapon will be the chili crisp that you introduced me to. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God, that stuff is definitely a secret weapon.
It's got a nice crunch.
Sauteed mushroom, you just drop a little tiny spoon in there. You just dab at the end. Sauteed chanterelle, like right now, this time of the year, brown butter, and then you drop a little bit of that chili in there. Oh my God.
So this, if you haven't seen this before, it's called Mrs. Rao's, R-A-O apostrophe S. You won't find the name on the jar. It's all in Chinese. But there's a black and white picture of a woman on the jar, and it's called Chili Crisp.
That's what it says, Chris. Yeah, Chili Crisp.
Chili Crisp. So, Nick, I'll give you the last one. When in doubt, use a white plate. So when you're plating food and you can't figure out what to do with it, use a white plate. It's going to show off everything beautifully.
Yep, that's what I would say. You know, that's one thing that I would say when you're looking for those plates at home. You know, it's one thing to do the home good. Oh, I got a great plate here. You know, things like that. But if you're looking to really kind of plate and show off like a great chef, you just want to start with a white plate so you understand what you're looking at first, and then you kind of grow into those more clay plates and things of that nature that you see a lot of people doing. You know, so you want to understand your detail first.
Yeah, like the salmon you brought for us today on my Spanish plates that have a lot of detail. They almost look a little bit Moroccan in a way. That salmon would totally be lost on there,
right.
Whereas on a white plate, it just pops.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks. That's Nick Novello from Pier 57, and we are going to thank you for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you, folks.
Up next is our Taste of the Week. Don't go away. We're on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's time for our Taste of the Week. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
We're coming to you from Large Studios this week, our fabulous producers here at LARJ Media. And next week, we'll be back at the Hot Stove Society and enjoying the company of you all who buy tickets and have breakfast with us and listen to our show there and participate in what I consider a really fun couple of hours every morning. So
I consider that, too.
Okay. Our Taste of the Week. You know, we try here to find something that we've eaten around town, that we've made ourselves, that a product maybe that has piqued our interest. And so we're going to start with Tina, our producer. You brought in this weird little thing.
Super weird.
They are weird. I thought I was eating meringues for a second. It's kind of what it reminded me of. But,
or some very dried out chickpeas.
But they are water lily seeds that are air popped or puffed.
Yeah,
or
they're called Asha Pops. And I was in Los Angeles. And the thing, you know, I went whole food plant-based, so that means I don't eat processed foods. So I try not to eat processed.
I was going to say, that's processed.
But I like snacks. This is processed. I like snacks. I like snacks a lot. So I always look for something that's kind of unique and delicious, but still kind of fits in with the whole food plant-based thing. So I found these little Asha Pops, and I read the back. It's a nice little story about a mother and her son that make these Asha Pops out of Los Angeles. And they are popped water lily seeds. They're high in plant protein, magnesium, and vitamin B6. So that's good, at least. You know,
I think it's good. I really don't know. Sounds good.
I know it sounds healthy, but
when you hear the word magnesium, God, that sounds good.
It's good for you. Might not taste good, but these actually really tasted tasted great. And they have some pomegranate and carom seeds. So they're salty, delicious. They've got a fun little crunch, and I just wanted to share them with you.
And a little spice, too.
Asha Pops. And I actually was so excited about them that I contacted them and said, where else can I find them? And they said, well, where would you like to buy them? And I said, PCC Markets in Seattle, Washington. And they said, all right, we're going to go look at PCC. So maybe you'll find Asha Pops in your local PCC.
And that's A-S, how do you spell it?
A-S-H-A-P-O-P-S. I'll put this on our Facebook page, too.
All right, and puffed water. It reminds me a little bit of what is that cereal, that puffed cereal that...
It looks like Cocoa Puffs.
Cocoa Puffs.
Yep.
Cocoa Puffs.
And they do have a chocolate flavor. I wonder if the chocolate flavor tastes like Cocoa Puff.
No, I'm thinking like puffed barley, not Cocoa Puffs.
Oh, yeah, sugar pops.
Is that what those are? Like frosted puffed barley?
Sugar Smacks.
Sugar Smacks.
Oh. No, smack something. Oh.
Smack your daddy.
People are listening in their car just like, I know it. It's Sugar Pops or Snaps.
Yeah.
Don't
smack your daddy.
Chef Terry, what did you have that you loved this week?
Oh, I had so many things in the last week. But one of them was celebrated a little birthday at the Loft above Pike Place Market when shopping around the market. And
happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday.
Cooked for 14 people. It was a lot of fun. And I had everybody partake in the game. You know, make them clean the kale, slice the chanterelle. A friend of mine came from Debab Bay and brought a giant bag of white chanterelle. Beautiful chanterelle.
That's a good friend to have right there.
Yeah. So did some ribeye steak and some duck on the grill on the barbecue outside. It was fantastic. We had a fantastic evening. But I want to talk about a place where I went yesterday with a couple of friends. We went and met at a place called Baker's. It's a fairly new place, cocktail bar. In Sunny Hill. Sunset Hill, pardon me. What did I say? Sunny Hill. Hill sounds better. Sunset Hills, yeah. And I had a delicious couple of poo-poos there. Lamb ribs, fried pork heads. They call it pork heads. You know, little cakes of pork meat from the head. And that was absolutely delicious. And the cocktail, I had a Chilcano, which was based with Pisco. That was absolutely fantastic. If you live in that neighborhood or close by, it's a great place to pop in and have a nice little cocktail and some poo-poos.
Yeah, it's on 32nd, I want to say. And if you want a place in your head, if you know where Ray's Boathouse is out at Chilcho, if you just look up the hill from Ray's Boathouse, that's the area where talking about. So.
What's the name of that restaurant across the street, the Italian restaurant that's been there forever?
Piccolino.
Piccolino. It's across the street from Piccolino. It's at a stop sign. It used to be a video store a long time ago.
There's a green market there.
Yeah.
And there's one of my old sous chefs has a new restaurant there called, begins with an S. I can't remember the name of it. It begins with an S.
You got to go down in that neighborhood and check it out because it didn't used to be as happening as it is now. But that place is really delicious. Baker's, I recommend it. Great cocktails. Nice, delicious little poo-poo. So go.
Well, my taste of the week is... sad but true, we got big frost at the farm, and so right before that, we had to pick all the tomatoes, and I had a loaf of Macrina country bread, and I pan-fried the Macrina country bread in olive oil and then lots of salt, and did the last of the season sliced tomatoes on top of the warm, crunchy toast. My goodness. Who needs avocado toast when you've got a fresh sliced tomato toast? It was so good. And that Macrina bread, you know, I know they're ubiquitous now. They're in every marketplace. They have some interesting products that I really like. Like, I like their green olive focaccia.
Yep.
I like their little cheesy rolls that you they're kind of trashy and good. You pop them in the freezer, and then some night when you're making a stew or something, you just pull them out, and for the last 10 or 15 minutes while you're finishing your stew, you just pop those rolls and frozen into the oven, and they come out just steaming hot and cheesy.
And cheesy.
Like, you know, when I say trashy good, you know, that's my kind of food, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know that everyone knows that. I don't want Macrina to take offense, but that's pretty much the highest honor in my book when I say it's trashy good. I really am liking the Macrina, a lot of their interesting little rolls.
Yeah, no, they do a great job.
Samara is the restaurant over there on 32nd. S-A-M-A-R-A. And I want to say Eric Johnson is the owner. I can't say that I know that for a fact. But he's doing a good job, and it's right next to that Baker's cocktail bar.
Yeah, absolutely. Very nice, and it's not my neighborhood, so I went there. Cyril lives down there, and went to visit down there. So it was very interesting and very nice, and the place is really nice. They do a good job. I thought it was very on point, the food, and the cocktails really match, very much on point together. So I would definitely recommend it for, an early night and go there and have some cocktail and some poo-poos and make it, make it a night.
I'll throw another plug out there, and I don't know if you've seen them or not, but the first chef that took over for me when I was finished being the chef and I hired someone to take my spot on the line, her name was Joan McIsaac, and she was just in town visiting this week, and that was in 1994, I think, when she took over, was the first chef after me at Dahlia Lounge, and she started a company called Effie's Homemade, E-F-F-I-E-S, Effie's Homemade, and it's a biscuit company. Or a cookie company. I would say she would call them biscuits. They go with cheeses. They're sold at most of the Murray's cheese stores
at the Kroger
markets. Like if there's a Murray's at Fred Meyer or QFC or something like that. Effie's Homemade. Try these biscuits. I think they're fantastic. She's got a corn biscuit, an oat biscuit, a chocolate oat biscuit, and a pecan biscuit, I want to say. And they're really good.
Effie's it is.
A wonderful visit with her. Okay, coming up next, we're going to celebrate Oyster New Year at Elliott's Oyster House right here on Cairo Radio 97.3. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. Thanks for hanging through that long wait. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
We are excited that it's time to come here for Oyster New Year.
Absolutely.
Do you ever think about Oyster New Year, or do you?
I think of New Year and oyster.
It's time for oyster.
No, I think that oyster for New Year is a great idea. Oyster New Year is a great idea, and oyster all the time except July and August is a fabulous idea.
Fabulous idea. Well, in honor of Oyster New Year, down at Elliott, we've invited their chef Robert Spalding to join us. Welcome, Robert.
Good morning, Tom and Terry.
Good morning. You have brought us quite a spread. Includes scallops, salmon, beautiful Dungeness crab legs, shrimp, fresh raw gooey duck. It looks like maybe a gooey duck ceviche of some sort.
Yeah, a little gooey duck ceviche.
Mm-hmm. And an array of fresh oysters that, we're not at the hot stove today, so we don't really have a kitchen facility. And there he is out there in the waiting room shucking oysters. And it's like, dude, you're all in. This is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, so you definitely went all the way in. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, it's quite the buffet. So I will just say, when we looked up and asked Sean, our sound engineer, this is not Sean, don't call me Del Torre, this is Sean
Fox.
Sean Fox. He was looking at the oysters like, hmm. And we said, have you ever had an oyster before? And he said, no, he hasn't. So we are going to have Sean have an oyster for the first time in his life.
Life.
How old are you?
23, soon to be 24.
So your parents just hated you. They didn't expose you to oysters?
No, from a really young age, I remember my mom and my grandma both telling me that like oysters were just like nothing that was served in their house. Something that just wasn't a thing, so they never came in the house.
All right, Robert, when you must get people that are having oysters for the first time, what do you tell them?
We generally recommend that the first oyster for somebody be a smaller oyster and something with a flavor profile that is reminiscent of other foods that people have eaten. Kumamoto's are a perfect oyster because they have a really melony taste and frequently are very sweet.
Okay, so then tell them how to eat an oyster. You've shucked them. That's the hard part.
Yeah.
How do you eat that oyster?
My favorite way to eat an oyster is just to pick it up and tip it and eat it with nothing on it.
Sometimes you have to get your tongue in there to get it off the shell, but I'm assuming he's shucked them beautifully, that it's just going to release because he's cut the top muscle and the bottom muscle, which is why that oyster will slide right out of there.
All right.
And you can chew or just swallow, your choice.
I just went for the straight swallow. That's really good.
That tastes like the sea, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's nice. It's like got a really good salt to it that kind of sits on the back end of the palate.
Oh. Mom and grandma, you're missing out.
Wait. I'm call my grandma after this. We have a conversation, grandma.
Yeah, exactly. What the heck?
That's really
my mother
good.
Would never eat an oyster either. That's okay. Okay. She's from Chicago. They don't get oysters there. So.
But we do need to have a comeback on what she's going to say about why you couldn't eat oysters, because I'm very curious about that.
So, Sean, every year at this time, Elliot, it's Oyster House, which is considered one of the best oyster bars in the country, has this Oyster New Year, and so you now need to make a trip.
Yeah, I'm going to bring the family.
Yeah, if you want to bring your grandmother down to Oyster New Year, it'd be a wonderful thing to see you, and maybe she can get into oysters as well. And if not, there's plenty of other stuff there she can enjoy.
Yeah, salmon, crab, you name it. Okay, Thank you, Sean.
Yeah, thank
Back
you.
Back to the board with you, sir. Robert, Oyster New Year is November 2nd.
Yeah, November 2nd from 4 to 8 p.m. We have VIP tickets available still. You can get them on elliottsoysterhouse.com or just Google search Elliott's Oyster New Year. We're going to have about 28,000 oysters. Those are all going to be shucked in the course of 4 hours. And it benefits the Puget Sound Restoration Fund, which works to restore and maintain the waters and surrounding habitat of the Puget Sound. So it's a great cause. The benefit has generated over $100,000 over the years for Puget Sound Restoration Fund. It's a huge party, and it's a lot of fun.
I've never been, Terry.
I have never been either. I keep hearing about it, but I just haven't. What day of the week is November 2nd?
The first Saturday.
Saturday.
Yep.
That probably is one of the reasons why I haven't been able to make that.
It's busy. Busy in the restaurant on
Yeah.
Saturday.
That sounds like a blast. So I'm sure you have all kinds of oyster wines and oysters themselves. What would you tell? I mean, we just saw a young man have his first oyster. Loved it right away. I wouldn't suggest to him that he eat 24 of those right off the bat because you never know. A lot of people are allergic to this or that, right? Or you have to break yourself into oysters.
Yeah, you know, start out with a half dozen and go to a bar where there's a good shucker or good servers that are familiar with oysters and are willing to talk with you about oysters. That way you can tell them what you like as you go through oysters and you try different oysters. I'm going to know if I like salty oysters or sweet oysters or oysters with a little bit of crunch, large ones, small ones. It's really individual people's tastes as far as oysters. And so when going out to have oysters, it's important to try to find a place that has a selection of different oysters and people that work in the restaurant that know oysters.
And really important, huh, Chef, that they know how to shuck an oyster. Because
Correct.
It is a little bit difficult when you get in there and you get an oyster in your mouth, and all of a sudden
half
you've got
of it
shell
is shell.
Everywhere. So I mean, it can happen, and I don't consider it like the worst sin ever to get a shell fragment. But you don't want a lot of them.
You also don't want it in every single one of your oysters because you're spending your time spitting shells of oysters, mm-hmm. as opposed to enjoying the flavor of the oysters. So.
Or if you're on a date and the oyster slaps you on the chin because it's not cut off the shell correctly, it can be embarrassing. So good shuckers are important.
So, I know I watch shuckers and they kind of go in through the hinge, which is that kind of pointed end of the oyster, and then they slide their knife across. That's never been how I shuck an oyster, and I don't imagine I'm doing it correctly. But I go in through the hinge, I pull my knife out, you know, I give the pop, I pull my knife out and clean my pop because sometimes there's some dirt in that hinge that you don't want to add to the oyster. And then I slide my knife across the top shell and take off the top muscle or cut off the top muscle. And then I get rid of that, and then I scoop in underneath the oyster. Now, what happens because I do that is that sometimes I ruin the mantle look of the oyster. Mm-hmm. It gets a little ruffled, whereas I consider a perfect oyster like this one here, where the mantle of the oyster, the head of the oyster isn't punctured, the mantle is spread out around the oyster shell beautifully, and there's no shell fragments. How do you take your oyster?
Well, I shuck from the hinge, and the best way to shuck an oyster perfectly is to pop it open and then just pry it in enough so that you can see in between the shells and carefully put the knife down the top of the oyster to cut the mantle on the top, as you were saying. Then after the top shell's off, cut the adductor on the bottom and flip it over.
Oh, you do flip the oyster?
I do flip the oyster just to ensure that the bottom adductor is completely separated.
Oh, okay.
However, it's not necessary.
I always thought that was a no-no for some reason.
I know, me too. I thought that was a no-no. Well, that's interesting. I do exactly like that, except I don't flip the oysters.
I only flip it when I puncture the oysters.
To hide it.
I always tell my cooks, it should be sleeping. Don't wake it up. Be gentle with that oyster. Robert Spalding, thank you so much. From Elliott's Oyster New Year, Elliott's Oyster House, November the 2nd on Cairo Radio 97.3.
Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen here on Cairo Radio. My name is Sean. I am usually behind the scenes here at Cairo Radio and the Seattle Kitchen. But last week, while recording this show, I messed it up. I screwed it up so badly that I had to go through the archives and find some audio that could actually be deciphered on the air. So that's taken us to right now, this moment. Tom and Terry discuss cast iron skillets and why they are awesome, why you should have, why everyone should have a cast iron skillet in their kitchen arsenal. And if I had a role for an iron skillet in an upcoming movie, I would cast that iron skillet for that role. Bad Jokes on the Radio, Seattle Kitchen, Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
We're going to talk right now about making dinner out of using only one pan throughout the evening. And I'm going to start us off.
Okay. I'm waiting.
Are you?
Yes. What kind of pan are you going to use?
We're going to use a cast iron pan. So let's talk about, first, cast iron pans, right, and why or why not should you buy them used or not, right? There's obviously, Lodge makes a huge variety of cast iron pans.
Correct.
One of the cool things about their pans that you buy today is that they're pre-seasoned. You remember buying cast iron pans early on?
Yes.
And putting the oil on, putting them in the oven for 8 hours, yeah, and doing all the seasoning work.
Salt.
And then you get it too hot the first time and it burns the seasoning off and you have to do it all over again.
Correct.
But these pre-seasoned pans work beautifully. They work a little bit like, you know, the Le Creuset pans,
right,
or the Staub pans that,
correct,
are enameled. So they maintain their edge and cook very much the same way as a American style cast iron pan.
Right.
So I say buy a used one because you're buying its history with the pan. And if you look at the pan, like I keep my mother-in-law's cast iron pan. When she passed, we got her pan, and I look and revel in her history of cooking in that pan with all the burnt-on drips and just the kind of the crustiness of it. It's not crusty as in dirty, but it's crusty as in years and years and years of use. And I find that in this world of throwaway kitchen tools and throwaway everything, that cast iron relives your family history in a way that very few other kitchen tools do, because knives wear out. Like if you inherit a knife or maybe even a sifter is probably,
right,
one thing that kind of makes it through the,
right,
the system. But so that's why I would like to either inherit or buy a used cast iron pan. What about you?
Well, I've got three cast iron pans hanging on my pan rack and pot rack in my kitchen, and they're all bought at Goodwill. Three of them in one time. One day I went to Goodwill to drop some stuff. I hate when I go somewhere to drop stuff and I pick up stuff. It's like, wait, you just defeated the purpose here. But I walked in just, you know, giving my stuff away. And then I looked around because I just had a few minutes. And I saw those three cast iron pan. I think it was like $6 or something crazy like that. And I was like, oh, my God, I got to buy those pans. Those are just like you. I was like, those are historical. You know, somebody's been using those pans. Maybe, who knows, maybe 10 different people have used those pans. So I bought the pan and I seasoned them and been using them for probably 15 years, not, mm-hmm, 20 years. And when I die, they can give it away to somebody else, you,
yeah,
know. And but those are almost indestructible.
Well, if you've pre-owned them, they're probably worth at least $7 now.
I've raised the value. But no, I mean, I think it's really cool. And I think they're indestructible. They're also... I mean, I wouldn't use a cast iron pan to make a sauce, for example, because the liquids in there, when you reduce it down, you pick up some flavor you don't necessarily want. But to sear anything, mm-hmm, a cast iron pan is godsend. I mean, it's like, it's really, really a good piece of equipment. You know, you just have to be patient. When I put it on my stove, I walk away. I come back 15 minutes later to make sure the pan is actually hot, like if I want to sear a steak or something. I do not.
But,
do not stay in front of my pan ever.
But you don't want to burn off your seasoning.
No,
I mean, if you're going to use it for blackening, like Paul Prudhomme did, and the blackening,
that would be a dedicated pan.
But that's a dedicated. That,
yeah.
I wanted to make that distinction. That's
absolutely
a dedicated pan that you've burnt the surface off, and you continue to burn it off every time,
correct,
you use it.
Once once it's burned, you do have to reseason. I mean,
so my first thing that we're going to have for dinner when I invite you over to my house for,
sure,
a little cast iron one pan dinner, I'm going to make cornbread, and I'm going to take my cast iron pan, put some bacon fat in the bottom, and I'm going to pop it into my 450 degree oven. And I'm not talking about some bacon fat, I'm talking about a lot of bacon fat. And then I'm going to pull it out, and when it's super hot, and I'm going to pour my cornbread batter into it and put it back in the oven, and it's going to cook in maybe 10 minutes because of the super hot pan. But in that 10 minutes, I got the head start on the browning of the cornbread, right? And then I'm going to pull it out, and when it's warm, I'm going to slather it with butter. And then I'm going to serve you a little bit of the Michter's rye, neat, with our cornbread. And we're going to sit there and get started in a good old-fashioned way.
We might never get finished.
We might never get finished at that. Okay, now the pan is yours.
All right, so I'm going to do sardines. Because
oh,
I love
my God.
Sealed sardines. I have a pan dedicated just for fish, just so it's clear. One is just for fish. But I love
This is our family heirloom. You're going to put sardines in my family heirloom?
Of course. Your family needs to expand a little bit. So a little bit of duck fat in the pan when the pan is hot, and seal those sardines really well. And then when the sardines are cooked, just put them on the side. And it doesn't take very long to cook a fillet of sardine. It cooks really fast. Then take the fat out and make a quick vinegar and mustard dressing, kind of, but on the spot with the hot fat, and pour that right over the sardines with a little heat in there, harissa or something like
that.
Ooh.
Now I'm going to wash the pan, because my course. I'm going to wash the pan for 15 minutes.
And you got to season it.
I'm going to fumigate the house. And I'm going to put it back on
your
the stove.
Your house has seen a lot worse than that. I know that.
I'm going to put it back on the stove. We're going to get it super hot. And I'm going to spatchcock my chicken, which is basically just taking the backbone out and butterflying the chicken. And I'm going to season it super well with salt and pepper and just put it skin side down into my hot pan and going back into my 500-degree oven.
Mm.
But I'm going to put my second cast iron that I own and set it on top of the chicken, because that's my brick, right?
Yeah, you know,
that's what instead of using a brick, my second pan is my brick. And we're going to pull it out and serve that chicken with a delicious smashed potato, like a mashed potato, but I like the skins in it. Just red skin potatoes, lovely, with my crispy roasted chicken.
Oh.
And it's going to be so good.
And those potatoes.
And those potatoes. And maybe a little steamed asparagus. And now you have dessert in that same pan.
I'm going to do a tarte au thym, but I'm going to do it with Nathan's figs, because we had Nathan on earlier, the first part of the show, and he has a lot of figs. So I'm going to use some of his figs. So make a nice little caramel on the bottom of the pan, and then put all those figs laying down on there. A couple of apples, just because I want to put apples in there too. And then put a nice puff pastry on top of that. Put the whole thing in the oven and bake it really well with a little cheminée in the middle so the steam comes out. Then when the whole thing is ready, take it out of the pan, flip it upside down, toss the whole thing, you know, pat the whole thing together so it's really smooth and gorgeous looking. And then voila, you know, in the pan I got still a caramel left, nugget of butter and a little bit of port. Remember that port I was telling you? You didn't use the whole bottle. So I'm going to put a little port in there, deglaze, and then use that as a syrup right on top of the tart. And if that's not good, just make some whipped cream with it. It will be delicious.
Yeah. A little whipped cream on that.
Yeah.
Take some of your fresh bay and steep your cream in the bay or with the bay.
Oh, actually, you could use that anise hyssop you have outside and, you know, put it into your cream. It'd be delicious.
So when you do that, you just simply take your anise hyssop or your mint or whatever and bruise it up, pour your cream on top, and let it sit for an hour, and then strain it out, put it into your mixer with some sugar, and make your whipped cream out of that. And you got a nicely scented whipped cream that isn't scented, say, with Grand Marnier or something more traditional.
Sure. Oof.
Boy, we made a heck of a meal.
Coming up next on Cairo Radio on the Seattle Kitchen. We all know that greens are good for us, but how good for us are they?
What?
Well, Tom and Terry are going to break that down coming up next on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in a hat.
It's time for questions from you, our listeners, on Cairo Radio. Hopefully you're in your kitchen or in your garden closing up things for the fall, or maybe picking some pumpkins.
Oh, you're looking at your fridge wondering what you're going to do with what you got in that fridge.
Tina, you've been on our Facebook page. Let's check in with you.
All right. It is very active. If you want to ask a question to our chefs, head to Seattle Kitchen on Facebook and join the conversation. Here's your first question, you guys. Eddie Martinez is asking about lard. He says, what's a good substitute for lard when making tamales? Make tamales?
Duck fat would work well, too.
I wonder why no lard. That's the question. Is he not meat-based?
Oh.
So I'm just curious. It needs a little more information, but duck fat is a little bit has a lower melt point than lard does, but it would be fine. I've used whole butter before.
Yeah, butter would work fine too
in my tamales. So I think all of that would be
all
fine.
Right. On to the next. All right, David Feaster is asking about hollandaise sauce. He says he's making hollandaise sauce, and it's very precarious. So, one, what are the chef's go-to recipes or methods for making hollandaise sauce, or do you have a reliable whole egg version as well? Any tricks on hollandaise?
Whole egg? What's that mean?
A whole egg version is what. Mm-hmm. So you put the whites and...
Oh, I've never done that, so I don't know. But basic hollandaise is melted butter on the side of your stove, and then in a big bowl with water underneath, like a water bath, you just whisk in some egg yolks. And I like to put a little champagne in there because I just love the...
No, wait a second. You just kind of went... You don't start with the butter and whisk in some egg yolks. You whisk some egg yolks, right?
Correct. But the butter is melting.
You're using clarified butter.
Correct. But you start with melting the butter because it takes longer.
But the way you said it, it sounded like you whisked the egg yolks into the butter.
Oh, no. Not yet. You whisk the egg yolks in a big bowl over water bath, medium heat, and you put a little liquid in your egg yolk. It could be water. It could be wine. I like to put champagne. And you whisk that until it fluffies up to at least three or four times the size of your egg yolks. Without being scrambled. You want to make sure it doesn't boil like crazy underneath because you don't want it to be curdled. And then once that's cooked to about 160 degrees, 170 degrees, you put a mid thermometer in there. Then you can slowly incorporate your melted butter in there. And then you just keep whisking and whisking. And at the end, a little squeeze of lemon juice to finish it up, salt and pepper, and you've got a marvelous hollandaise on your hand.
I like a little Tabasco, too, personally. I put a little touch of Tabasco.
All right. Pat Hergert is asking, how do you keep your gas range cooktop clean? The cooking shows have grease spattering and stuff falling into burners. I know they have people cleaning up behind them, but I do not. Getting my first gas range soon, and I feel unprepared. Thanks. Love your show.
I know how I do it. So I have a gas range, and
what do you do?
It usually comes with iron grates on it, and then you pull the grates off, and then you just take a green scrubby. And I'm not a person that's worried about scratch marks from the scrubby. You know, once you do it several times, you go through and do the whole thing, so it all looks like it's been scrubbed, right? So you don't end up
just
with just scratch marks, right?
Right.
So that's how I do it, and then I run my grates through my dishwasher, and done.
Yeah, I mean, cooking does involve cleaning, and the other solution is don't cook.
Yeah. Go out to restaurants. We like that.
All right, Mark Peterson wants to know, do you have a favorite way to prepare fingerling potatoes?
I love them. It goes with my favorite dish. So my favorite dish to cook is a rotisserie duck, right? Low and slow over the fire, and then I put a pan of fingerlings right under the duck so that it catches... A 5-pound duck will give you 2.5 to 3 cups of fat, duck fat. And so as a duck is dripping over the potatoes are cooking in the warm base of the barbecue.
Tom, Terry just I'm hungry.
Wow. Right,
you know, the only difference is I take small Walla Walla onion, cut them in quarter, and add that to the potatoes.
Yeah, delicious.
And then the onions caramelize and confit slowly into that fat. And lots of fresh herb, you know, like if you have a little fresh thyme, and then at the end, lots of chopped parsley once it's cooked. Oh.
So the other way, if you're not doing duck on the rotisserie, which I know you're probably not, is just make sure you put a whole stick of butter. Now, sometimes people feel like if you're using a whole stick of butter for those potatoes that baking in the oven,
right,
that you somehow have to use all that butter, and you don't. That butter is, you just drain it off like you might bacon grease,
yeah. And
then use it for another purpose if it's too much butter. But you want that much butter in there for the potatoes to cook in.
Correct.
Right? So...
Alrighty. Emily Sakuma wants to know, do Tom or Terry have any recipe sites they look to for ideas, or how do they get their inspirations from eating out at other, or do you get your inspirations from eating out at other chefs' restaurants? How are you inspired?
For me, I'm all of the above.
Yeah, me too. It's all of the above. There's not one source.
I know, Tom, you like to travel. Like, I remember before you were opening Catina Lina, you went around and studied tortillas or something. I remember you talking about that.
And I went to Mexico City and I did a few things and found out the story of the Mexican tortilla is one of the inspirations between ours, which is the Mexican tortilla is sponsored or it's the price is held up by the government. You have to serve and sell tortillas at a certain price.
Mm.
And the government regulates the price of the flour and of the tortillas.
Wow.
So it has become a very homogenized thing. They're still perfectly delicious, but they're different, right? Heirloom corn had gone away, and they went to this bulk homogenized kind of corn that wasn't very interesting. So then when I started playing with heirloom corns, all of a sudden my tortillas got super interesting and delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought, we cooked the corn. I bought a volcanic stone grinder. So we grind our own maize and we make our own tortillas. And so even with a tortilla, you can do it better with effort.
I just love that you got some inspiration by actually, you know, traveling around and taking a look at places. And you can certainly see some of that from the artful ways of food. Terry, what about you? Where do you get your inspiration?
For me, it's the same thing. I was raised in, as often Tom mentions, you know, a little bit of a box in terms of this is what food is all about. And this is French and this is what you do. You know, going and traveling around the world has definitely been an eye opener of like, well, wait a minute. I love this very much. I want to put that in my food. You know, and that's how you cross the bridge, basically. You go to Vietnam, you try some nice vegetables you've never seen before. You come back, you're like, hey, I want to put that in my food because... So next thing you know, you got a little Asian influence through the French food, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's just a matter of, you know, you don't lose your style of cooking, for say. But, I mean, I'm not obviously going to mix necessarily, you know, like we talk about Mexican food. I'm not necessarily going to make... cochinito pibil tomorrow, but I'm definitely going to take the pork leg and roast it and melt it down to where I can use that meat and maybe make it into a terrine or something, you know, something very different in terms of the fabrication of it. But the basis is the same. You're using the idea of cooking that chicken, that duck leg, pork leg, pardon me, in, you know, wrapped up and cook it until it melts down is the idea. So, and the spices too, when you travel. You know, like when I was in market in Merida, which was a beautiful market. You see those color of spices. These women are standing in front of those giant, round, deep baskets of like green, red, yellow, all different kind of peppers. And you're like, what the heck? What are these? You know, and then you start trying it and you go, wow, each and every single one of them is a different flavor. And so you start asking questions. Where do I get this? You know, and so on and so forth. And then you reuse it. Into, you know, you're making a duck consommé, and then you figure, you know, I'm going to put a little bit of that yellow ajee that I tried in Peru or whatever, just to give it a little side flavor. That's how it works.
All righty. Your next question comes from Lucienne Puh. Sorry, I'm probably not pronouncing your name correctly, Lucienne. She says she bought a 5-pound, 8-inch diameter kohlrabi from the farmer's market, and she's wondering what the heck to do with it.
Return it.
Return it.
5 pound.
Wow, that's
eight inch diameter, yeah. Kohlrabi. It's quite a kohlrabi.
You know, it might be fun with that. It's not going to have a lot of flavor, right? So there's these Okinawa pancakes that have a lot of cabbage and bacon and shrimp in it, and a little bit of rice flour slurry. And I would just move my, instead of cabbage, put my shredded kohlrabi in there. And make a delicious pancake out of that and shave bonito flake over the top and maybe do a little sweet teriyaki as a dressing for that. That, to me...
You could shave it and use it as a slaw as well, or you could just roast it and make it into a soup. You could make a nice kohlrabi soup.
Or you
could
return it. Use it as a doorstop.
Yeah. You might actually be able to make money.
All right. We have time for one more. Sandy Russo wants to know about your favorite fall dinners, something that you're thinking about cooking for the fall.
Well, I was working with Chef Kyle at Palace the other night, and he had a gnocchi, which I think of as kind of a fall pasta, and did it with chanterelles and charred broccoli florets over the wood fire. He took the broccoli florets and just gave a nice hard char, and the combination was just fabulous. I loved it.
I'm 100%. When I think fall, I think mushroom. I mean, the diversification of mushroom that we have here is the diversity. I mean, is unbelievable. Lobster, chanterelle, anything, pan sauteed, roasted, soups. I mean, there's all kind of different things you can do with mushroom that this time of year is really, really quite essential fall.
All right, that's all the time we have. Up next, it's our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. I'm looking forward to that since I got crushed last week. And we'll be right back on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
Time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Tina from Large Media is going to be our presenter.
Quiz giver outer?
You're going to be the woman behind the curtain.
I am. All right. Well,
you dare question Oz.
Pay no attention to that woman behind the curtain. All right, y'all. Here's how it works. You each get five questions. Whoever gets the most correct is the winner. Whoever gets the most answers wrong is the loser. And that loser is going to have to give something up to an audience member, someone who loves our show. Today you'll be playing for Mark Peterson. He asked a question earlier in the show about fingerling potatoes. We are also lucky enough to have Chef Robert Spalding from Elliott's Oyster House join us for the quiz today. Are you nervous?
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit. Well, it's fun. Well, I promise you'll
you
have a good time.
Be. Chef Terry is trouble.
Have you ever heard the quiz before?
I have, yes.
Okay. Dun, dun, dun. All right. So, Chef, we forgot to tell you. But if you are unfortunately not the winner today, you'll have to give something away. We'll start over here with Chef Terry because he's often not the winner. What will you give away? Sorry, Chef.
Damn.
He was perfect last week. Weren't you perfect last time?
The time before. Last week, both you and I lost.
That show didn't air. See how I did that? Oh. I play the one where Ethan stole.
I'm going to give. I'm going to give the same thing. I'm going to give Branch for Two at Luke in Madison Valley on a Saturday or Sunday.
Wonderful experience, especially in the fall. The sun's out. Yeah. Hang out over there. It's beautiful. All right, Chef Robert, what would you like to give away?
How about a $100 certificate to Elliott's Oyster House?
Ooh, that's a good one.
That'd be fun. Sean, you should win that one. Then you can go down and have a feast at the Oyster Bar.
I love that we turned Sean onto oysters.
I know, right here in front of our eyes.
Yep. You always remember.
Yeah, always remember you had your first oyster.
I had my first oyster at Oyster New Year, actually, probably 15 years ago or something.
Yeah, I really did. My first oyster at Elliott's Oyster House about 30 years ago.
Well, that's so fun.
Didn't know I was going to work there.
Tom, what will you give away?
I will give away, since Edison Seatown have oyster bars, too. I hate to break it to Mr. Spalding, but I will give away a $100 gift card to either Seatown or Edda's down there in the Pike Market.
Awesome. That's super fun. All right. These are great prizes. Who would like to go first?
I'll start.
All right, Chef Terry, your first question. What term describes food where an ingredient, such as a vitamin or mineral, has been added for dietary purposes? You have some options. Is it A, fortified, homogenized, pasteurized, or Ayrshire?
I thought Ayrshire was the western side of Scotland.
Well, so it's not that. I bet it's not that.
I'm going to go fortified.
That's the answer. Good job. All right, question number two. What is another name for the fifth basic taste, sometimes referred to as savory?
The fifth taste, umami?
Yep, that's it. Good job. All right, your third question.
Pulled that one out of the hat.
I know, I really do. He's like, wait, I think it's this. True or false, most banana breads are not quick breads. Is that true or is that false?
False.
You are correct. Banana breads uses a leavening agent, most commonly baking or soda powder. Yeah, that's
I never heard of
three.
Anybody making banana bread for 3 days.
All right, that's three for three, Chef. Your fourth question, true or false, processed cheese is an American invention.
False.
Wow. That was
said. It's a French invention.
Yeah, well, or Swiss, really.
Yeah,
but
Swiss, actually.
Maybe they both, who knows. Okay, your last question for a perfect score. What happens to food when it goes through the Maillard reactions? You have some options.
Okay.
It liquefies, it solidifies, it turns brown, or it freezes. It
turns brown.
Correct. That's a perfect score.
Wow, way to go,
I
Chef-y.
Take back Whoa! My what I go. Said at the beginning. That
That's
was right. lovely.
That's what you get when you insult
That's,
Chef.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you get. You get me going there.
Right?
I'm like rattled out.
With a vengeance. I'll show you, producer Tina. All right, Chef Robert, are you ready?
Absolutely.
The term oligustus was proposed by a group of scientists as the sixth taste. What was that term? Was it tannin, sele, caustic, or fat?
I'm going to go with tannin.
The answer is fat. Oligustus, apparently fat. That was, I mean, if I can't pronounce the word, it's not fair to give you the question, really.
I should have paid more attention in my Latin class.
All right, your next question, true or false? You should never eat chocolate with white spots or streaks. Is that true or false?
True.
The answer is false. The white marks are known as blooms and are just when the fat crystals rise to the surface.
Yeah, it's more of a coloring issue.
Also will arise if you put a drop of water.
You want to say pay $85 a pound for it, but it's not bad.
All right, question number three, Chef Robert. Which of the following ingredients is found in many commercial red food dyes? Chicken feathers, ground insects, flower petals, or rhubarb stalks?
I'm going to go with ground insects.
You are correct. Wow, who knew? Gross. All right, question number four for you. True or false, storing tomatoes stem side down allows for tomatoes to stay fresh longer?
I'm going to go with false.
That's right.
True on that one. The true or false ones, it's just not fair. They're just getting you. They're just getting you on this one. All right. It's trivia. These are trivial. All right. Question. Your last question. The cooking method where meat is cut up, sauteed, or braised and served with its sauce, traditionally a white sauce, is known as what? Fricasse? Did I say that right?
Fricasse, yeah.
Thank you. A la matonaha, parboil, or coulisse?
What was the first one?
Yeah.
The first one.
Fricasse.
Yeah, what is that one? Exactly. Good job. 2 out of 5 correct.
So
good
you're
Lord.
Saying I have a chance.
Yes. Chef, your 2 is the number to beat today. Chef, your first question. Roquefort, feta, and Manchego are all cheeses made from the milk of which animal? Of what animal? Which animal?
I'll say
correct. I don't know how you got that one right. You're so smart. All right. Which of the following pastries is not a show pastry? Danish, profiteroles, cream puffs, or eclairs?
Danish.
Correct. Ooh. You need to get the next. You did get 2. Now you are tied with Chef Robert. You need to get this one correct to be a possible winner. True or false? According to the National Carrot Museum in the UK, carrots' original color was purple or white.
Is that either or?
It's true or false. True or false. According to the National Carrot Museum.
True.
Yep. 3 for 3. You want to see if you can get them all right?
Sure, why not?
Okay. True or false. During the early 19th century, ketchup was used as an indigestion medicine.
Sure.
4 for 4. Your last.
Can't make that stuff up.
I know. He's like,
it's also during the 1980s, it was considered a vegetable.
Yes, it was.
Right.
Okay, your last question. Which of the following shellfish is capable of free swimming? Oysters, scallops, clams, or mussels?
A free swimming. I will say scallops.
Yep, scallops it is. That was 5 for 5. Ooh. You two. Nice job, you two, from Terry.
Robert, we're so sorry to humiliate you here on the Seattle Kitchen Show.
We tried to be nice to our guests, but...
This show is produced by the team at Large Media, including Sean Dottore, Abigail Long, and Tina Null. That's at LARJ Media. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to HotStoveSociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. It does come with a delicious Dahlia Bakery breakfast sandwich. And remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to Seattle Kitchen on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening.